Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Swigert here on behalf of the appellant, Ibrima Susahor. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you.
Mr. Susahor was charged with both rape of a child and violation of a protection order. The jury instructions on the protection order charge asked the jury to find whether there was a court order for the protection of a sexual assault victim. This language assumed the existence of a victim, thereby implying that the sexual assault accusation was true. This was a judicial comment on the evidence in violation of Article 4, Section 16 of the Washington Constitution, and we therefore ask that Mr. Susahor's convictions be reversed. Under Article 4, Section 16, judges may not comment on matters of fact. Judicial comments are presumed prejudicial unless it's essentially inconceivable that that it could be found that the fact did not exist. I'd like to first address the reasons why these jury instructions violated the Washington Constitution, and second, move on to the prejudice question.
Let's talk about prejudice first. The jury had State Exhibit 39, which was the sexual assault protection order. How did this jury instruction that you've challenged tell the jury anything they didn't already know from Exhibit 39?
The sexual assault protection order itself, well, I have two answers to that question, actually, Your Honor. First of all, the difference between the sexual assault protection order in Exhibit 39 and the jury instructions, which is that the protection order itself does not refer to the child ARC as a victim. It refers to a protected party. It also specifically states that it can be issued when the person is arrested for, charged with, or convicted of a sexual assault. So it doesn't assume that this fact has already been proved. Second,
it assumes something, doesn't it? Because if someone just claims they're a victim of sexual assault and the court doesn't believe them, it's not going to sign an order protecting them, is it?
Well, there certainly are different standards of proof that we're talking about here, whether we're talking about conviction in a criminal trial requiring proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Different standards, but isn't the jury being told that some judge, by just seeing this order, some judge has already found this child's story credible enough to issue a protection order?
Credible enough to issue a protection order. That may be sort of a preventative measure. We're going to do this in the meantime while we figure out essentially what happened. It doesn't give the same import. And that leads me into the second reason why the sexual assault protection order itself is not as a problem in the way that the jury instructions are.
This is a temporary order in the sense of 14 days until we have a hearing and sort out what's going on. This order lasted from August of 2009 to July of 2011. So the court had conducted an evidentiary hearing and made some findings as to what was really going on. This wasn't just let's wait and sort things out and make sure we protect somebody until we do.
But it's still very different when what you're looking at here is an exhibit that's given to the jury as evidence for the jury to assess and for the jury to determine the import of that exhibit. Whereas instructions 17 and 18 are the court's instructions to the jury on what the law is. The jury is instructed that it must accept the law from the court's instructions. And so whether you have something like that, perhaps indicating a judge's opinion in an exhibit, which is a question of fact for the jury to evaluate and weigh the import of that exhibit, is very different from when you have it suggested to the jury in the instructions on the law that a victim already exists. And so that's why the mere existence of the sexual assault protection order and the admission of that exhibit is not the problem that the jury instructions that assume the existence of a victim are. The cases in which the prejudice presumption has been rebutted are cases where no one could realistically conclude that the element was met or that the fact existed. Those are cases essentially where the fact was undisputed or essentially undisputable. For example, in State v. Levy, when the court held that, okay, yes, it was a judicial comment to say that an apartment building was a building, but no one could reasonably conclude that otherwise.
What do you do with the DNA semen evidence?
Judicial comments are a problem even when there is copious evidence supporting the fact that the...
Can you give us any hypothetical where your client has not guilty, and that evidence exists.
That DNA was found in a pair of underwear that were lying on his bedroom floor.
Whose underwear?
Depends on who you ask. Depends on who you ask.
They obviously weren't his.
No. And the child's mother testified that they belonged to the child. However, we also don't know under what circumstances it got there. That could have been simply in a pile of laundry that was laying there on the floor, even if they did belong to her.
Pile of laundry on the floor, it's his semen.
Yes, Your Honor, but that does not indicate that there still is a possibility. It's conceivable that his semen was transferred to that underwear in some other way. For example, reaching for something to wipe himself off with. It's certainly conceivable that there's some other way that that DNA got on those underwear. It's certainly conceivable that those underwear did not belong to the child. So there's at least two conceivable ways in which that DNA does not make this case ironclad. And I would refer the court to State v. Jackman, where there was also copious evidence of the fact that was at issue. In that case, the jury instructions incorporated the fact of these young boys' dates of birth. All four of the boys testified as to their date of birth, and for three of the four boys, there was corroborating evidence of their dates of birth. And yet the court still stated it is still conceivable that the jury could have determined that the boys were not minors at the time of the events if the court had not specified the birth dates in the jury instructions. And so this case is directly analogous to Jackman in the sense that, yes, we have quite a bit of evidence here that certainly is damning of my client, but the fact that there's copious evidence does not mean that it's inconceivable that any reasonable juror could have found that there was no victim or that this child was not the victim of a sexual assault in this case. The reference to a victim in the jury instructions essentially amounts to a comment on the credibility of the victim. And so in addition to this DNA that was found on the underwear, the main evidence was the child's testimony. And the court in State v. Lane explained that the touchstone of error in a trial court's comment on the evidence is whether the feeling of the trial court as to the truth value of the testimony of a witness has been communicated to the jury. By assuming that there's a victim, the court's opinion that ARC was telling the truth was essentially communicated to the jury. The drafters of the pattern jury instruction on the protection order charge apparently recognized that this was a problem and warned in the comments that when there has not been a conviction yet, the instruction should be changed to use a more neutral term rather than victim, such as complaining witness. That's what the court should have done in this case. Judicial comments occur when it's even suggested that the jury need not consider an element or that the court believed the complaining witness, and that's what occurred here. We request reversal. Thank you.
And good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. May it please the Court, Lindsay Green from the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office on behalf of the State of Washington. This Court should affirm Sue Sahore's convictions for two counts of rape of a child in the second degree and one count of misdemeanor violation of a court order and hold that the trial court did not comment on the evidence in Instructions 17 and 18. And in any event, any error was harmless here, giving the overwhelming evidence of guilt on counts 1 and 2. Your Honors, I'd like to first address why the language in Instructions 17 and 18 is not a comment on the evidence. I've provided Your Honors with the instructions for the language in 17 and 18 and also with Exhibit 39, the pretrial sexual assault protection order. Whether something is a comment on the evidence is determined by the context of the facts and circumstances of the case. And here, the language of victim of sexual assault or a sexual assault victim is used to mirror the type of order that was issued, a pretrial sexual assault protection order. The language in the instructions is a correct statement of the law and does not allow the jurors to infer what the judge's opinion is on counts 1 and 2.
Why wouldn't you need the word alleged to avoid having an inference that the person has indeed been found by the court to be a victim?
And, Your Honor, and I would concede that using the term alleged or using the term protected party would be a best practice here. However, even though that is a best practice and it was not followed here, I don't believe that in the context of this case that the language of instruction 17 and 18 does rise to the level of a comment on the evidence. Here, these remarks were not only oblique references to counts 1 and 2, but are also isolated. And no.
Can you call someone a victim if you don't think something happened to them?
What is unique in this case, in these instructions, that does not allow the jury to resolve the ultimate issue on counts 1 and 2, these instructions don't say a victim of sexual assault, to wit, ARC, and ARC is the named victim here, nor do these instructions.
Except that ARC isn't ARC the person protected by this order?
In a pretrial sexual assault protection order.
So the jury knows who the person described in the order is. It's ARC, and the court says victim. I mean, it's a two-step process rather than a one-step process. But in analyzing whether there's a comment on the evidence, the court doesn't, the opinions don't tell us. You just look at the instruction. You also get to look at what the evidence was in the case. So we would look at this order as well, and this instruction can't be talking about anybody besides ACR.
That's correct. And the jurors are aware that this order was issued pretrial. The date of the order was issued 2 weeks after the rapes occurred. There was testimony from the detective that the order was about when the order and the pretrial order was sought.
But if it was just to protect through trial, why would it not expire until July 21, 2011, when it's entered on August 3, 2009?
And, Your Honor, that is just a matter that the order was in effect until that date. It's
well, that suggests this is a normal protection order entered for the term of a protection order without regard to the trial date or the need to protect somebody just so a trial can occur.
And I think the worry that the jurors would interpret that the protection order to be read in that way is obviated by the use of the term pretrial sexual assault order, which is the actual.
Where does it? It's there's a box checked pretrial, but it says in the title sexual assault protection order, and then there are two choices, pretrial or post conviction down below. The order doesn't talk. I mean, the jury instruction doesn't talk about a pretrial protection order. It talks about an order for the protection of a sexual assault victim.
That's right. And the use of the term sexual assault victim in that context is simply a mirror of the type mirrors the type of order that was entered, a pretrial sexual assault protection order. And the order itself also indicates that it's issued for someone who was arrested for, and it goes on from there to note that this is not that the ultimate determination of whether or not the sexual assault has occurred has not been resolved by the issuance of the sexual assault protection order. And, Your Honor, a second reading of the jury instructions, which is not in my briefing, which occurred to me as I was preparing for oral argument, is that the instructions actually require the jury to find an additional element for count three by requiring that the jurors, before they may convict on the misdemeanor violation of the protection order, to first find that there was a victim of sexual assault, requiring first that the counts one and two be resolved before.
Does the rule of lenity permit us to indulge in that reading?
Well, Your Honors, I don't believe that would not affect the outcome here. I just believe that it's another reading of the jury instructions to put forth.
Do we even need to consider that argument given the rule of lenity?
I think the first argument is that there is no, that this was not a comment on the evidence. And in any event, the comment on the evidence is isolated. It's one that was oblique, and it's one that was cured by other jury instructions by the court. This is not a situation where the trial court at any point during the trial referred to ARC as a victim or referred to her as a victim of a sexual assault. These instructions were also cured. The jurors were instructed that they were the sole deciders of any issue of fact. They were instructed that the trial court would not intentionally comment on the evidence, and they were admonished that if the trial court inadvertently did so, that they were to disregard any such comment. The jurors were also instructed that they must decide each count separately, and that a verdict on one count should not control a verdict on any other count.
Were the jurors given similar instructions in Jackman?
Your Honor, Jackman very concretely resolved a material issue of fact. And in Jackman, another...
You're not answering my question. My question is, were jurors in Jackman given those other instructions that you are pointing to now to essentially argue harmless error?
And I'm sorry, I don't know directly whether those specific instructions or if all three of those instructions were given to the jurors in Jackman. I would like to highlight the differences here between Jackman and the present situation. Here, Jackman does not, nor does any other case cited by either party here, nor am I aware of the existence of any case where a court has found that a comment on the evidence has arisen from a remark made in instructions referring to an entirely different count. And that's what happened here, that the remarks were made in instructions solely related to count three, and defense is asking this court to find this oblique remark, these oblique remarks in instructions 17 and 18, to have corrupted counts one and two and all of the other instructions. Essentially, to find a comment here, the jury would have needed to ignore all other instructions by the court, all of the instructions.
Given time slipping away, why don't you assume that there is a comment on the evidence that this court's not happy with and talk about prejudice?
Thank you, Your Honor. If the court does find that this was a comment on the evidence, any error here was harmless, given the overwhelming evidence of guilt. Here, the record affirmatively shows that no prejudice could have resulted. This is not a case where there was scant evidence. This is not, as Sus Horace claimed, a case where it was a he said, she said, or a credibility contest. There's overwhelming evidence. As Judge Leach pointed out, there is DNA evidence of that the defendant's DNA matched sperm fluid located on ARC's underwear, which was located in the master bedroom, in Susahor's bedroom, crumpled up on the floor. That corroborates
so
the information.
He took them out of a drawer and masturbated in them. Now you got the DNA there. That doesn't amount to the crime that he's charged with.
When Susahor was first contacted by police, he gave unbelievable explanations to police. While he admitted to fondling her, to cuddling ARC and kissing her, he denied raping her. When he was asked by the detective if he would be surprised if his DNA was found inside of ARC as a result of the sexual assault exam, he said he would not be surprised. And he gave two different examples. He said first that he would not be surprised because he believed that ARC manually stimulated him while he was asleep to the point of ejaculation, and that she then took his semen and put it inside of her. Alternatively, he claimed that what may have happened is that she had sexual intercourse with him while he was sleeping. He didn't wake up. And, Your Honor, that's the highlight. Those are some of the highlights of the evidence that support the overwhelming evidence of guilt. This court should affirm Susahor's convictions on all three counts. Thank you.